This interview is for the Veterans History Project of the Library of Congress with Joseph Hester Smith, who served in the U.S. Marine Corps from June 1943 to December 1945. Today is Friday, February 8, 2008, and we are in the television studio of WILL on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana, Illinois. My name is Harriet Williamson. Also in the studio are Henry Radcliffe, who is the videographer and director of sound and lighting, and Mr. Smith's wife, Laverne Elizabeth Roberts Smith. I was wondering if we could start by you talking about your background, about your family, about your education, and anything else you would like to mention at this time.
Well, I was born in Maywood, Illinois. In 1923, so I'm now 84 years old. My mother and father had lived in Virginia, in the southern part of Virginia, in Charlotte County, and they had moved along with a number of other people from the south to places in the north to get employment. And my father landed in Maywood, Illinois, because there was a steel mill there which employed a number of people, especially people who were moving north from the south. And he was invited there to come there because of my wife's father. They had been friends for a long time from birth, I'm told. And so her father, Jack, as he was called, told my father that there was employment, and so he came there and eventually sent for my mother, and so that was my first home in Maywood, Illinois. I remember a few things about my childhood there. They were happy, as far as I could tell, eventually my mother and father separated. I think I was 6 or 7 years old, and I remember taking a train trip, first time I'd been on a train, to a faraway place, and we eventually stopped in Virginia, where my mother's mother lived, and that was the first time I'd met my grandmother in Charlotte County, Virginia. We stayed there for a time, and my mother, who wished to, who planned to go on to Boston, where the matriarch of our family was, and that was her Aunt Beulah. Aunt Beulah had lived in Boston so many years. We often think that she was right after those people who got off at Plymouth Rock, and she was as stern and as puritanical as any of those people were. But my mother went there to join her and to find employment after the separation from my father. And I remember we stayed with our grandmother for a few years, and I began school in the elementary school, in a country school of sort. I think I was about 7 years old then, and I went through school, loved school. It was from the very beginning, and I was considered a good student, or as they say, I was right smart. And so at that time, very few people from the school went beyond that. That was sort of the end. And my mother had aspirations, and so did I, of going beyond that. And so she had heard of a school in another county, in Mecklenburg County, it's called Thine Institute. And she had wanted to go there as a girl. I don't know how she learned about it, but she said she had always wanted to go there, and so she was going to send me to Thine Institute. So I was sent off to boarding school. And it was convenient for her because she was a domestic and worked in those big families, some historically significant people in Boston, as a matter of fact. And she, my first year was a marvelous one. I was like many of the other boarding school students whose mothers had to work, but who could at least afford to send the children to boarding school. And the point of all of that was to keep us off the streets, out of the street, and to get a good formation while the parents worked, because many of the, our parents, and my mother particularly, lived in those days. Maids lived in the house of the employer, and so it was a around-the-clock kind of thing, and so there was very little home life. And so, in a sense, boarding school became my home for all practical purposes, and it was the boarding school that formed me, my early years particularly. And so I entered Thine Institute and let's see, I've forgotten the year, 37, I think it was, about 37, 37, about that. And I spent 5 years there, 5 years before I was graduated. And it was a significant time in my life. In many ways, feeling fatherless. And often motherless, especially when my mother became hospitalized. After my first year, was glorious. It was a school that believed in everyone working, notwithstanding how rich you might be. And I should say, too, it was run by the United Presbyterian Board of Missions, so it was a Presbyterian school, and the student body was made up, the boarding school, primarily of Northern students, mostly from Philadelphia for some reason, a few New Yorkers, people from New Jersey. Not many from New England. I was about the one person. No, there was another person from Connecticut. But that constituted the student body. But my real education came in living in the dormitory, as they called it. And very soon I took to to learning easily, because I had, it was a sort of passion, particularly when I was living with my grandmother, that that was perhaps the most desolate time of my life. There was a constant yearning, mother, father, and all sorts of things that I couldn't really understand. And one of the things that saved me during that period, as I recall, was my grandmother wrote to my mother and said, Joe has read every piece of paper in this house, up in the basement, and I mean upstairs in the attic, and every trunk that I could find something to read. And my mother would send packages wrapped in paper, newspaper, Boston papers, and I'd take the papers and spread them out and read all of those. It was like a hunger. And so she asked my mother if she could spare some money so she could subscribe to a paper. And it was the Richmond Times Dispatch. And you can't imagine what that did to me. Well, I say it helped me survive, because all of a sudden I knew there was a world outside, beyond these confines. In this rural area, people are very insular, and everything is isolated, it seemed to me. And there I found all sorts of things that were going on in the outside world, and it became a part of our family. My grandmother particularly, there was a story about a bear in the serial, Blackie the Bear. And whenever the paper would come, or at night, we'd sit in the room, and my grandmother said, Joe, read to me about Blackie the Bear. And I would read, and the other children, my sister who was with us, and I had two cousins who were there with me, and their mother. And so I would read to the family about Blackie the Bear and other kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Well, that was my first real education, other than the fundamentals in the little country school. And so I then, as I said, went on to Thine Institute. And there I found some of the most wonderful people at a time that I needed wonderful people. And most of them were white. And I say that because I point out the race, because the encounters that I had later on with whites were so different from those that had formed me in Thine Institute. The principal, Frank Wilson, Dr. Wilson, was the headmaster. The kindest, most gracious, long-suffering person, because boys, especially those, some of those guys were just a few steps ahead of the truant officers and all of those people, and they were sent there so somebody would keep them in line. And my favorite teacher, one of my favorite ones, and my favorite one was my English teacher, Miss Wilson, who was the daughter of the principal. Stern person, but I thought a marvelous teacher. She introduced me to so many things. I still have the book of poetry that we use, magic casements, magic windows into the world. And she often says to some of the boys, this is not a reform school. Those who found difficulty shaping up. But they were very kind, gracious, and worked hard to give us a good education, limited, particularly in science. I didn't have much science, but literature, I enjoyed literature, of course, and social studies, and Latin, and rather good in math. I wasn't too good in math. Geometry was almost my undoing. But I came through and was valedictorian of my class after 5 years. I graduated with honors. But I should go back and say that my first year, as I said, was glorious. The other 4 years were rather difficult because my mother became hospitalized, and I thought I was going to have to drop out of school. But Dr. Wilson said, no, no, we will find a way. We will find a way. And we found a way. I worked more than that 1 hour that everybody had to work. And there was a wood pile where you had to saw wood and chop wood. And my job became that of a fireman, a boiler. I attended a boiler. This school was co-educational, so mine was over in the girls' dormitory, which was a safe distance from the boys' dormitory. So that became my job for about, for 3 years. I had to take the wood in and stack it in my boiler room and keep the fire going. And I learned to bank fires, what wood would keep the fire till the next day. And I just learned so many things and how to keep water in the boiler and all of that. And so I was gaining a degree of confidence and self-worth as well, and that was very important. And then my last year, Dr. Wilson came to me and said, Joseph, you have done so well. I'm going to promote you. I'm going to promote you. So he gave me, proposed that I become the study hall director of for the little boys in the dormitory. We had boys there who were in the elementary section of the boarding school. And at night it was very difficult for them to stay in their rooms and study. And so he thought that somebody should be over them. So we had a room downstairs where I would gather them and bring them in. And if they had problems, their teacher would give me instruction, leave a note in the classroom saying, help so-and-so with such-and-such. And I enjoyed that. But the main job was to keep them quiet. Some of them pretended to be reading, but it was primarily to keep them quiet during study hall hours. And that was a enjoyable job. Mm-hmm. I never thought I would be a teacher eventually, but I look back on it and that was the beginning of my teaching. Well, after 5 years, I said I was valedictorian of my class, and it was small enough that you could do everything. So, and you didn't have to be very good; you just had to be enthusiastic and willing. And so, I developed a number of things. I was in the dramatic club, and I did plays, and I was in the choir and the chorus, the boys' glee club and everything. I was on the basketball team. It was that kind of place you could explore your entire being. And it was the most is most delightful. Now, this was in a place called Chase City, Virginia, in Mecklenburg County. Now, here are all these northern people in this southern place. So we learned about riding in the back of the bus, and we knew there were places in Chase City we couldn't go to. And the theater, where movies were shown, all black people had to sit up in the top. And that was a little difficult to take. But we were so glad to have a chance to get off campus that we endured that sort of indignity. But it, too, was a part of my education. And so we when we got ready to go home, we used to just go as we pleased when school was out. And we decided that the best thing to do would be to charter a bus. And so we chartered a Greyhound bus that came on the campus, and there were enough of us to to board the bus and continue north all the way through past the Mason-Dixon line. And so we didn't have to suffer the indignities of the southern rules and regulations about giving somebody your seat or not being able to get on the bus until all the white people had gotten on and all of those things. It was a great comfort because the first stop for all of us, I think, was in Trenton, New Jersey. So then we began to thin out all the way, and the final thinning was a girl who was in Connecticut and I in Massachusetts. We would get a trailway and go the rest of the way. So that was the kind of thing, but I learned about segregation. I knew about segregation. One of the things that I remember most vividly was once I was alone, I don't know what year it was, and I was on the bus, and it was one of those Greyhound buses that had an aisle that was recessed, and the back, there was a back seat along the ledge, somewhat like where I'm sitting here now, and a straight aisle, and it was down, and the seats were up around it, and I was sitting in the back as I knew I should sit, and a white man came on, and the bus driver came to me and told me to get up and give him my seat. And I couldn't say, I said, well, I'm in the back of the bus, but I was the first person in the nearest bus, and so I had sort of made a line. This halfway is back of the bus, but I wasn't far enough back. He made me get up, and I started talking about the Constitution, of which I knew very little. And a black man in the back, he was sitting in the long seat in the back, said, son, come on back here. You know, and sit here on this old Gladstone. Ain't nothing in here you can hurt. And so he had a Gladstone bag. I didn't know what a Gladstone was, but an old leather bag. It looked rough, but it was soft, and they closed it. So he put it down there, and I sat on the ledge on that Gladstone bag, my feet in the aisle, and really it was more comfortable than the seat all the way. But I remember with so much thanksgiving that black man who got me out of that difficult situation. I rode comfortably on until I got beyond the Mason-Dixon line, safe up north. Well, that pretty much sums up, in a nutshell, I suppose, my high school education, which meant so much to me. During the summers, I'd go somewhere and work, and I remember the first job in the world was Atlantic City, New Jersey. I had friends in Philadelphia, and I stayed with them, and they took me to Atlantic City, where I almost starved until I found a job. That was part of my formation as well.
What happened to your mother?
My mother was still in the hospital. Most of the time, a long thing. She had one thing, another, all kinds of things. And then after she got out of the hospital, she was in a convalescent home for a number of years. As a matter of fact, she didn't come out until I was graduated from high school, and we were beginning our life together, which was a significant time. I want to say, during the time in high school, too, I developed all kinds of skills. I learned wash and iron. I learned to sew. My grandmother taught me how to sew. I'd learned to do all those domestic things. I knew how to go to the shop and get to put a half sole on shoes. My frayed collars with a razor blade and turn the collar around and stitch it back. All those kinds of make-do things for which I became most grateful later on. But after graduation, I went on back to Boston, and my mother and I, my sister. My sister was in boarding school for a short time with me. We went on to Boston and started trying to find a house. My mother was still rather weak, but she was looking for work. And so I became the main source of employment at the time. Fortunately, I found a job at the Boston Port of Embarkation, because this was in 42. The war was on, and someone told me that the Boston Port of Embarkation was looking for workers. And so I went and signed up and soon found a job. And that was a great joy, because then we had some income. We found an apartment, and my mother had a part-time job at first. And we moved to a house. I still have such fond memories of the place. It was on Symphony Road in Boston, just about a half block or so from Symphony Hall. Oh, I loved the place, just a plain apartment, but I had my room, my sister had her room, my mother had her room. I think we were the happiest that we'd been. The family, which had been scattered and scrambling, had finally come together, and we were on our way, I thought. I had two ambitions. One was, of course, to see that my family, my mother and my sister, were housed and fed, at least. And the other was just try to save some money to get to college. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but that was my ambition. That was my mother's ambition. My father could never understand, I discovered later, why I wanted to go to college, because I had finished high school, and you know, that's nobody in the family had done that. And then when I wanted to go to graduate school, he that just staggered his imagination. There I was. I had no ambitions at all about going into service, because I had business to take care of. I was going to do my duty when I was called. I was going. But I didn't think about it and wonder, where I should, what service I should go into. I just waited and worked and waited and worked, and finally, after about a year, my number came up, as they say, and I went down to the draft board, reported, and I was told when to report for examination. And on the appointed day, I went down to be examined. And we went through all kinds of tests. At one point, we were all in huddled, this, I don't know, a room full of guys. Mostly white, I think maybe one or two black guys in it, yeah, but mostly white guys. We were all in our, as we would say in the Marines, in our skivvies, and standing around, and after a while someone called my name, Joseph Smith, and I looked around. Will you follow me, please? I followed him. It was a Marine. I don't remember now whether he was a corporal or a sergeant, or his dressed blue uniform. So he said, I've called you out because you're very special already. I didn't know about recruiting and they did that because I was called out from the midst. I said, yes. Would you like to be a Marine? So I don't know much about the Marines, except that it's part of the Navy, and I don't want any part of the Navy because all I could do there would be a cook. I said, I already know how to do that, and so I'd rather go someplace where I can learn something else, like drive a truck, for example. I said, I don't know how to drive a truck. I said, so that would be some advancement. I said, but cook, no thing. He said, well, no, the Marines are part of the Navy, but they give you the same training that they give all the others. There's no difference. You go to boot camp, and you learn to train, and you become a fighter or a warrior or something. He said, no, it's all the same. I said, And of course, had done no research on the military, except I'd been in Boston, and Navy people all around there, and I had known some Navy people, and I knew that most of them were stewards, and I never talked to a Marine, because at that time, all of them were white. And all the white guys that I knew were my age, and we'd work together and bowled together and all of that sort of thing. And so Marines were not on my screen at that time. But he talked to me about, you completed high school. I started to say, hasn't everybody who's reached 18? I discovered later that that was not so. And my physical fitness had so it was rather flattering that he wanted me to join the Marines. So I said, well, of course, the same training and all of that. Well, all right. So I became a Marine. And so I went back home and told my mother, I've been recruited for the Marines. She said, oh, it's nice. I don't know much about the Marines. I said, nor do I, except as part of the Navy. They I say, I guess they're the fighting part of the Navy on land. I said, this is the best that I can understand. So I had a date at which time I was supposed to go, leave Boston to go to camp. And this is where the great adventure began. We were to meet at a particular place in Boston as a group. And when I got there, the group consisted of about four white guys from different parts of New England, Maine, New Hampshire. I don't think any Vermonters were there, but Maine and New Hampshire. There was one another white person from someplace in Massachusetts, but out of Boston, wasn't in Boston. I was the only black person there and the only person there from Boston at the time. And so we stood around and finally went down to South Station and caught the train to go to Washington, D.C., the first leg of our journey. And we, of course, sat together because one of the persons was in charge of us. He had papers and he was in charge of the detail, as we would say. We got to Washington, D.C., and we had to wait some time, it seems, for a train to go to Rocky Mount, North Carolina. And we waited and waited and waited. Finally, the train came. We started boarding. We started on one of the coaches. The person in charge of us stood by the steps and with the conductor, while the rest of us started getting on. Two or three guys went ahead of me, and when I started, the conductor put his hand and said, "No, where are you going?" And I said, "Rocky Mount, North Carolina." Mm-hmm. He said, "I mean, you can't sit there." And so the person in charge said, "What do you mean? You can't sit up here?" "No, he has to sit somewhere else." I said, oh. Now, I naively felt that, okay, I'm in the Marines now. It doesn't matter if I'm going south. Uncle Sam is watching over me. Mm-hmm. And, but he insisted, well, person from Maine who was in charge, he said, "Well, if he sits there, we're going to have to sit there too." So because I'm in charge of the group and we've got to stay together. Mm-hmm. So the conductor relented, got on. So I got on the train with the rest of my new buddies. And there were just a few men on the train, white men, reading newspapers and glaring at me. Uncomfortable, but I ignored it, and we just talked together, anticipating what we were going to get into in our Marine induction. The camp. Well, we went on and on and on until I heard the conductor say, I think it was Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Now, I had papers which said I was supposed to transfer at Rocky Mount. But I didn't know. I thought they had papers too, said Rocky Mountain. I said, well, here's where we get off. And I started getting ready. I said, no, we're going to, we don't get off here. I said, well, I'm supposed to get off here. How is that? He took my papers. He said, I don't understand this. I said, I don't either. He said, we're going to Paris Island. I said, I don't know anything about Paris Island. Mm-hmm. He said, but that's where we're going. That's where the Marine Corps camp is, boot camp. And the other guy said, yes, they were going to Paris Island. I said, well, I'm supposed to get off here. We were all in a quandary, you know, it's what was going on. Mm-hmm. And it still hadn't struck me, because he said the recruiter said I was going to receive the same training. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to be in the same camp. Mm-hmm. So I took leave of my fellow enlistees and got off the train, began to feel lonely again, isolated. So I got off the train and just walked back and forth right where I got off, back and forth, back and forth. And I saw no people in the station. Mm-hmm. I was, okay, well, there weren't many people who were on the train anyway, so I thought this was just an isolated station. Not like South Station in Boston, you know, mm-hmm. million people is a small place. And so I waited and waited, and after a while, the train came. And lots of coaches, some were actually empty, just one or two people and others. And so I started hurrying to get on board, and conductor, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to, I think it was Jacksonville. That's where, that was the next stop. Jacksonville. He said, I mean, you can't sit up here. You have to go down there. You see those people there? You follow them. And I looked down there, and there looked to me like hundreds of black people who were apparently in the back of the station, because I hadn't seen anybody mm-hmm. at the time, and I hadn't gone to the back. I just mm-hmm. walked back and forth along the track. They were streaming out to the train, and they were all going to one coach. And I said, they can't all get in that coach. You go to, if you're going to ride in this, that's where you go. Oh boy! So I went on down, followed them, and it was the most wretched experiences. There were women with babies and bundles and boxes, and it was in August, hot. North Carolina is hot, hot, hot. In August, and we got in there crammed in as you can't imagine how it was inhuman. And some men went through and sat, got in. There was a baggage car, there was there was an engine. And I don't know whether there was a coach between the engine and us or not, but then there was a back car. Some men went back and sat in the baggage car. But we were squeezed in, and the windows were open to get in air, and all you got were cinders, you know, flying in from the track. It was a miserable journey, and I felt sorry for the people. I was feeling sorry for myself. And I said, this is not a good way for me to start off fighting for my country. I began to rethink the whole thing, but, you know, it's too late now. Now, I say this because I knew about discrimination. I've already recounted about my experiences in Virginia, but I'd never seen anything this vicious. It just seemed cruel, especially when there was space. They could have still discriminated and just given more space to people, but no, all crammed into one car. So I went down, I got on the train, I got off at Jacksonville. The bus was there to pick us all up. I went to camp, and then I realized that this was a separate camp. Mm-hmm. The White Marines, my buddy, had gone to another camp, and this is where I was going. And that it was a new camp because Marines had just recently been permitted. And this was strange to me, being permitted to join. Mm-hmm. And I can understand because I didn't come and say, will you please allow me to enter the Corps? Mm-hmm. I beg of you. I was drafted into the service, and the Marine came and got me. So I couldn't understand why I was being treated as an unwelcome person or a person being bestowed upon in a condescending way, a high privilege. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't see it. And that was in the air, a high privilege of being selected to be a Marine because they're the best of all military people. Well, I was in the Marines in boot camp. Boot camp is supposed to tear you down and remake you. To tear you down, assuming that you, it seemed to me, that you had nothing worth bringing to the Corps in the first place, mm-hmm. you know. But they remake you into a Marine. And there were some things that I saw the value of, and that was unity, teamwork, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But there were some things which under the guise of training and discipline was simply sadistic. You know, that was plain and simple. Somebody mm-hmm. took it out on some people because, you know, it's like initiation or harassment. There was a great deal of that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's all supposed to be instructive. But not everybody needs the same kind of discipline, etc. The assumption seemed to be that you were nothing, and here you are, and we're going to make you into something, mm-hmm. Or whatever you were, we're going to strip you down of that and then form you in our image. And I resisted that psychologically. And the way I survived it was to say, what is it that you expect of me? At inspection, what am I supposed to? I'm supposed to have my person squared away, as we say, clean, everything in order, etc. My rifle is supposed to be clean and safe. I'm supposed to know the manual of arms, whatever. I'm going to learn it. So you won't give me any fuss. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear anything from anybody reprimanding me about it. No reprimands. And so I squared myself away, found out what I was supposed to do, and I did it with all the dignity. But I was not going to take away, let anybody take away my personhood, my fundamental virtues. I knew I brought something that I thought was of value to my country, if it were not to the Marines. Mm-hmm. But that was it. And on top of that, all Marines, I suspect, undergo that. I haven't found anybody who's going. But it was particularly grueling for those first ones of us who were in Montfort Point, because we had to prove ourselves worthy. The commandant and all of the senior officers resisted it to high heaven. No, no, no. We don't want them. President Roosevelt pushing it, but not too too much, because he wanted the Southern vote. And I think settled for the segregation that they eventually set up. At least they are there. And the NAACP was especially vigilant about, and I think some other civil rights organizations were telling them, these are Americans, they are men, and part of their being a good American is to serve their country in any of its organizations. And that is how I discovered later, that's how the Marines reluctantly opened themselves up. And so those of us who were pioneering at that point, we suffered. But I survived boot camp. And in boot camp, I learned fire a rifle, how to clean a rifle, M1. That was something new. I didn't know what I would do with that when I got back to Boston, but it was a useful thing to know if I ever got in combat. I worked in the carbine, I think they call it, another small arm rifle, not as accurate as the M1, but handier. And I learned to fire, I think it was a .45 automatic. I learned, what else do we, in the firearms. There was an automatic rifle called the BAR, B-A-R, Browning automatic rifle. Mm-hmm. I learned to fire it. So I learned to use firearms, and I learned to drill. We drilled and drilled and drilled. I learned to stand guard and the responsibility of being a guard and not to fall asleep, because that was, they made us think that was offense almost. Requiring capital punishment, and I found out later that some people overseas, particularly most people that I knew who were in the brig, were there because of sleeping on guard duty. Well, anyway, we left eventually there in Jacksonville, North Carolina. Montfort Point Camp. I refused to go on liberty. I simply said, I'll never go into Jacksonville again until I'm going out of it. And so I never went out on liberty. I stayed in camp. On one occasion, I left Camp Lejeune during my whole stay there from boot camp until after boot camp, before we started our trek overseas. I heard that my grandmother, I didn't know the geography too well, but I learned that my grandmother lived close enough to North Carolina, the part of Virginia that she was in, was close enough to North Carolina that with a 72-hour leave, I could get there and get back. And I wanted to see her before I went overseas, because probably, and it was the last time I saw her. So I ventured out on the bus again, some of the same treatment. I thought I'd learn. I knew I had to sit in the back of the bus, but I learned another custom. The bus driver was in the front, and I gave him my ticket and started to get on. No, you go in the side door. couldn't even walk through the bus. So, but anyway, I took the bus, got back, and saw my grandmother. But another confusing thing, I got to a little place where I was supposed to get off in Wylesburg, Virginia. Just a store, just a, like a juncture in the road. And I knew that my grandmother didn't live too far from there. So I got off the bus and went to this little general store. And the man said, "Can I help you?" I said, "Well, yes." He could see I was a Marine. And I said, "I have a grandmother who lives somewhere around here. I don't know exactly in which direction. I don't know whether I can walk there or whether there's a cab or something, but I'd like to see her." He said, "What's your name?" I said, "Etta Rice." "Oh, I know her." I said, "You do?" "Oh, yeah. I know everybody." And I guess he did. Yeah. He said, "Well, if you aren't in a hurry, I'll take you out there. I'm going out that way." Now, this was a white man. So, what do you do, mm-hmm. and when do you do? It's mm-hmm. all mm-hmm. mixed up. Mm-hmm. And so he took me to a pickup truck. I got in there. He didn't tell me to sit in the back of the pickup truck. I sat beside him. He took me over. He said, "Let me off." He said, "You walk down that this dirt road, this lane, more like a lane, and you get into the house." I thanked him very much. Mm-hmm. So I saw my grandmother before I left. And I don't even remember getting how I got back to camp, except that I got back on time, because that was the scary part. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't get back on time.
This interview is for the Veterans History Project of the Library of Congress and is with Joseph Hester Smith, who served in the U.S. Marine Corps from June 1943 to December 1945. Today is February 8th, 2008, a Friday. We are in the television studio of WILL on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana, Illinois. And this is part two of this interview. My name is Harriet Williamson. Also in the studio are Henry Radcliffe, videographer and director of sound and lighting, and Mr. Smith's wife, Laverne Elizabeth Roberts Smith. When we left off, you were talking about visiting your grandmother in Virginia and then heading back to Montford Point Camp.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you about the camp. I'm not clear where it is in relationship to Camp Lejeune. And I also wanted to ask you if you had seen Camp Lejeune, and if there was a comparison between the conditions at Montford Point versus Camp Lejeune, and also if you knew if there was any difference in the way you were housed or fed or clothed or equipped or trained as compared to the Marines that were at Camp Lejeune, and how long were you there before you were shipped overseas?
I know I've confused you. When I say Camp Lejeune and Montford Point, I'm speaking of the same place.
Well, I know they're the... Okay, so they are geographically the same place, but yeah. One is the segregated place and one is the...
No, Camp Lejeune was the segregated place and Montford Point was the... the basic training camp.
Okay.
It's Montford Point is the point is on Camp Lejeune. Whites were trained at Paris Island.
Okay.
Whites were trained at Paris Island. And so now there were undoubtedly whites in parts of Camp Lejeune, because there weren't enough black Marines there to keep the whole camp going.
Mm-hmm.
But it was primarily at that time for the training of black Marines. So our address was Camp Lejeune, Montford Point. It was Montford Point, Camp Lejeune, I've forgotten which. But it's one in the same place. And whites were had their training at Paris Island. Which
now,
is
how far away is Paris Island?
I don't know. Okay. It's a considerable distance.
Okay.
There was a place not too far from Camp Lejeune, which was called Cherry Point. At that time, that was where flyers were trained, Marine Corps pilots were trained. That was closer to Camp Lejeune, I understand, than was Paris Island.
Mm-hmm.
But the camp had just been developed. We didn't have we had no barracks at the time. There was sort of tar paper huts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they looked like, made of tar paper. And they were black, and in the heat of the sun, and they were hot, and miserable kinds of things. I often thought that tents might have been better,
mm-hmm.
but they were sort of tar paper huts, it seemed to me. And I've forgotten how many men were in the hut, but all in rows, just like you have in any camp.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole place was just recently developed. They had to find a place, and there was a great... there was a federal case involved in finding a spot, and so they put us out there in the place we say in the boondocks with the mosquitoes. There was a great deal of swamp land
mm-hmm.
there, and so mosquitoes were prevalent. The first battle that the Marines fought, I always thought was with the mosquitoes. There was a mosquito patrol. The men would go out and spray every in the woods and swamp spraying, and they'd come back and they were blacker than anybody. I mean, just covered with that spray. So it was very very primitive.
Mm-hmm.
Paris Island, they had better living conditions, but they had other pests. They had
mm-hmm.
sand fleas, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But the living conditions were basic, but I don't think anybody was even bothered by that, because when you're drilled all day and you're running, when you go into the hut, you sleep, and you
mm-hmm.
up early in the morning, out again. So the conditions there were I think rather primitive, but they're livable. Mm-hmm. And I heard nobody complain about the conditions, the heat or anything. And we didn't have anything to compare it to, really, because we had never been to any other Marine Corps camp. And so we survived that. That was not a problem. But and it was difficult to keep those things, even when you clean them, they didn't look clean somehow because it's just dull places. So we were ready now to start to go overseas. And I would say one of the questions you asked was, how long was I in Camp Lejeune? Mm-hmm. Montford Point Camp Lejeune, New River, North Carolina, in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all of that. There's a little river that goes right by the point, and so that was part of our address. I lost my train of thought. We were getting ready to go overseas, and I, from June of 43, I was there, through boot camp, I think, I forgot how many weeks, through August, September. I remember in October, I think we were in New Orleans. So we left Montford Point sometime between August and October. I think probably September. It was probably September, because I think my birthday is October 5th, and I think we were in New Orleans at that time, as I recall. But that was about the time that we were, not much time to strut around and be a Marine in the United States. Nobody ever saw me in uniform. None of my family saw me in uniform but once, when I came home after boot camp.
Mm-hmm. So you were able, now this is not visiting your grandmother, but this is going back to Boston?
It's Boston. Mm-hmm. Right after boot camp, I went back and saw my family, mother and sister, and I was in uniform then. And the next time, the next time they saw me, I was discharged. I'd been discharged.
Now, were you able to stay in contact with your mother and your sister through letters?
Through?
Writing letters?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Letters were, you know, email, and I think that was what it was called. And, yes, I wrote. I don't know how often, but I didn't tell them about any of this, none of this. So I'm doing well, et cetera, where I am and where I'm going. And so, yes, I think it was around September that we started out our journey overseas, and we were told that we were going to embark from New Orleans. So that meant we had to catch a train from Jacksonville North Carolina to New Orleans. Somehow we got on the train, and I remember it as a long and boring train ride. But then another traumatic thing happened. And I think I know that stayed with me longer than anything else that happened to me in the Marine Corps. I look back, I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but it did. It was a deep wound. We reached Tupelo, Mississippi. Pretty certain of Tupelo. And the train stopped for some reason. And up on the embankment was a canteen by the American Red Cross. Big sign, welcome servicemen, such and such a chapter. American Red Cross. And there were just mounds of donuts and urns of coffee. Wow. After, you know, grueling ride, we would get out and stretch our legs, I thought, and go up the embankment, line up, and get some coffee and donuts. And the train remained there on the tracks. And, we were waiting for the order to go up and get the donuts. After a while, a man came down from the hill, the embankment, came down the tracks, and he walked the entire length of the train, looking. He saw nothing but black Marines. He went back up the embankment, and they closed the place down. Like, out of business. I don't think I don't know why that hurt so, and hurt so long, mm-hmm. was the thing. And it hurt for two reasons, not only were we snubbed by or rejected by the American Red Cross, not one of our officers, we had, there were no Marine Corps officers, black Marine Corps officers at that time. Mm-hmm. We had acting sergeants in our outfit, black acting sergeants. We didn't even have a full sergeant at the time. And so you see how new we were to the Marine Corps. We hadn't, we didn't have a, have the full list of non-commissioned officers, and our commissioned officers were white. And remained that throughout my tenure in the Marines. I mean, there were no black officers in the Marine Corps until November, the year that I was discharged. A person was commissioned, a lieutenant. Mm-hmm. In November, I was so I never saw one. I never saw a black officer. As a matter of fact, I never saw a top non-commissioned officers. I saw one gunnery sergeant during my entire duty, one black gunnery sergeant, and he was one who had come from the States to replace us in Noumea, New Caledonia. And the first time we seen him, we hooped it up. A gunnery sergeant. It was a proud moment, because our gunnery sergeant, who was white, had told us, somebody said, "Hey, say Gunny." We call the gunnery sergeant Gunny. Gunny, we heard that there's a Negro. We were Negroes in that time. There was a Negro gunnery sergeant back in the States. "No," he said. "That's what I heard." "Well, when I see one of you people with three up and three down, I'm going to eat my stripes." And so we yelled when we saw this guy. He said, "Gunny, look, look, three up and three down. Eat them, eat them." Gunny said, "No, I guess I'll keep them." It was one of those high moments. But anyway, back to Tupelo, Mississippi. No white officer. I expect them to get off the train and say, "Feed my men." Mm-hmm. You know, this is what I fully expected. Mm-hmm. And when they didn't, I lost all respect for those guys. Mm-hmm. The only respect I gave them was what was due to them as a superior officer, but as a human being, a man, and I could not. I don't know whether they hid themselves or what they did, but not a one made a move. Now, to me, a good officer would say, "These are my men." Mm-hmm. You say, "Welcome, servicemen. They're servicemen. I'm lining them up, and you're going to serve them." Mm-hmm. But they didn't do it. And I said, "We're going overseas with this type of leadership? Those New England, that New England guy had more courage in telling the conductor, we're going to sit together. He's going to sit with us, or we're going to sit with him, than those Marine Corps officers did. And I wrestled with that, and no matter how I turned it, it came out the same way. They had absolutely no respect for us, or they would have gone, because there were no other white Marines. We were still the discriminated, or there were no other white guys around. All they had to do was line us up and up the hill, get some coffee and donuts. So it was one of those things that I could not shake. Every time I turned it around, it stuck with me. But anyway, we left there and went on to New Orleans. We went over to Algiers, right across the river. And Algiers is a naval receiving station, so we were over on the Navy side of New Orleans. And there, all we did was occasional drilling, and people went on liberty in New Orleans. I had never been to New Orleans, and I was anxious. We were told to stay together, you know, one or two guys, not a guy going off alone. So there, I've forgotten with whom I went, but his interests were not my interests. And that's one of the things you get in the Marines, were very interested. And the other thing is the composition of the platoon or the company I was in. It was practically all Southern boys. And I think that was true throughout. And it's also true that the Marine Corps power structure, made up of Southerners, the officers and etc., they're primarily Southern. And my officer, my platoon leader, or my company officer, did some spiteful things. He talked around how much better Southern boys were than Northern boys. I don't think there were three of us. There was a boy from New Jersey, one from Chicago, and myself. All the rest of them were Southern boys. And he'd talk about them. And I had one buddy who would say, call him a name, always trying to divide us, you know. It was insidious. Well, anyway, I went on Liberty once in New Orleans, and we were there for, I don't know how long we were in New Orleans. I so regret I had a log. I kept a log in a house, and it was one of the casualties in a flood that we had in our basement. Some years ago, I just thought about it. We had one day before yesterday, and that's when I lost all my little notes about my trip details.
Was it like a journal?
Yes. I called it my log. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it was a journal, except that it wasn't daily. It was more... event by event. And the all of New Orleans that I saw at that time was Rampart Street, which was a denizen of all kinds of things that servicemen look for. It was not the USOs or the canteens or something. Mm-hmm. The dives and that. So after that trip, I didn't go back. I didn't go to New Orleans anymore until I was free. And so we left New Orleans, we boarded an unusual ship for going overseas. It was an LST, so landing ship tank. They're not usually used for transporting troops long distances. They're good for hopping from one island to the next, for carrying men and cargo, but for long trips. Well, it takes a long time, and you have to make lots of stops. Well, that was, in a sense, good.
Is that an open ship? Is there cover on an LST?
An LST is one of the ships, one, that it opens in front, mm-hmm. and bow, and it has a deck that is pretty open, on which you store. We had an LCT store on top of it, which is a landing craft, a small landing craft. It's, you know, you see it, it looks pretty large when it's alone, but when it's with other seagoing ships, mm-hmm. it's rather small. But it was comfortable as anything. One of the things that boot camp prepared us all for, I'm sure, was discomfort. I mean, mm-hmm. Discomfort turned into comfort eventually. I mean, it was relative. You don't even think about comfort. You take it and you make comfort out of uncomfortable situations. Mm-hmm. We were told when we got on board the LST that we were the guests of the Navy and that we should conduct ourselves as guests. We were supposed to stay in the fore part of the ship. The Navy had the aft part of the ship. So we should behave ourselves as guests. That lasted for a few weeks. I don't know why, but eventually we were all over. And I think it was because they wanted us to scrape and paint the entire deck rather than just the fore part of the ship. Mm-hmm. And because that was what we did. We did a lot of scraping and painting of the deck after we had been out to sea for some time. But we left New Orleans, and the date is, I've lost that too. But we went on down to the Panama, we stopped before we went through the canal at, the name won't come to me now, but we stopped there for maybe a few weeks. That's where we got off and did some jungle training because we had never trained in any jungles mm-hmm. before. So we'd had our rifle and pack and go into the jungles of Panama. The Colon was a place not too far from, I think it was a city, not far from the base. And I think it was a submarine base, fundamentally. But we docked there, and so we go out in the jungle and, you know, get familiar with that foliage and the creatures in the jungle and all of those kinds of things and how to survive in it. You run out of water, what things get out of plants, just some liquid to live. And how to get through the jungle without killing yourself with a machete, trying to cut your way through. Useful things, I thought, and I appreciated that kind of exercise in the jungle of Panama. Then I went on Liberty once. To the place where we were permitted to go. We weren't permitted to go into Panama City. It was off limits or off bounds for Marines. I guess for all Marines. I'd like to think for all Marines. But we couldn't go into the city, the large city. But there was enough, as far as I was concerned, in this other small city where I visited just once, one night, and that was enough for me. I won't go into all the Marine Corps details of those places, like any other place where servicemen have liberty. Then we got on board LST and through the canal and on to Fiji. We stopped at Fiji, but we didn't get off at Fiji. We didn't dock at Fiji. We were there 1 or 2 days, and we were permitted to go ashore if we wanted to. Some of the men did. I didn't. We were out at sea, so you had to go, you know, over a rope ladder, I mean, down the side of the ship, the rope down into a boat, and a boat would take you ashore. The guys who were looking for something to drink were particularly anxious to find whatever aboard they could. And at that time, I didn't drink, and so I couldn't see any reason to go running around Fiji looking for a drink. There was one incident in which one of the Marines came back quite inebriated. I mean, he was so inebriated he couldn't. They brought him back, put him in the boat, and he couldn't climb the ladder. And so they threw ropes down and hauled him up. So I dragged him in and took him in and down below and threw him in his sack. And this was the first example that I saw of what some Marines considered a virtue. Our gunnery sergeant, who had served in China, and he had many, many years in the service, of course, it had been his life, he said. And his useful white gunnery sergeant, of course. And he pointed this guy out the next day when we had to fall out for inspection. Oh, damn it, I want to point out to you a good Marine. Yesterday we had to haul him up into the ship. But this morning he squared away. That's what I call a good Marine. That guy became a hero. To me, that was a detrimental depth of degradation. Why anybody would go and get so good. But another ethic, you see. Gunny thought that was a way a good Marine did. Go on, get drunk, but be able to stand inspection the next day. But anyway, we stopped at Fiji, and that incident, then we went on to, we stopped at American Samoa. We stopped at Tahiti. I'm not sure whether the order is correct. But the place that I remember most fondly was Bora Bora. Bora Bora was the most beautiful little place I've ever seen. There was a lagoon that was so so peaceful and inviting. You wanted to just dive in and go as far as you could. It was that kind of enchanting lagoon. And the island was sort of like curved like a horseshoe. And it was dominated by a ridge, a mountain of sorts. And we got up and we decided we wanted to go exploring. A couple of us went ashore and climb up the mountain. I'd never climbed a mountain before, or I suppose to mountain climbers this would be just a ridge. There was just one little peak that was covered by cloud. But we went there, and I didn't know the mountains had such various parts. We from shore, it just looked like an easy hike. We got into brush that was so thick you could hardly see, you couldn't penetrate. You said, you know, this is the mountain where you went through that, and then there was a barren section and on it. And it was a pleasure to get up to the top, and there was a place where we thought it was a machine gun up on one of the knolls, and discovered that it was simply a fake gun. That'd do a lot of good. They should be attacked. But Bora Bora was a very pleasant experience, as I remember. And I always wanted to go back to it. But we left there and on down to Noumea, New Caledonia. And that was where we were to camp. We were there. I really don't know how many months. It seemed like a year. But there a long time, because that became home in many ways. There was a small village not too far from our camp. I went there maybe three times during the whole time. There was an American Red Cross there that I think they gave out cigarettes to servicemen. I didn't smoke at that time, don't know. But I think they gave men cigarettes. I used to go to, there was a park with a bandstand on Sunday, I think it was. And there'd be a band, just that, and the people would come out, and it was an interesting custom. Young men and women would promenade the bandstand, and the parents were sitting out chaperoning, and they would just walk around. That was the courtship custom, and just around and around and around. I thought was interesting. But Noumea, New Caledonia was a very, it was a peaceful place, but we did what we were supposed to do, and there we came into our real service. And I haven't said anything about that. I discovered later that the depot company that I was in was a service company, and that we were not expected to do any combat. Combat was a privilege reserved for regular Marines. The irony is that at Montfort Point there had been developed two so-called combat outfits, the 51st and the 52nd Defense Battalion. There have been learned communications, they learned about the guns and, you know, all the kinds of things, and I think they had a rifle company. But anyway, it was in every sense a bona fide combat unit, 51st and 52nd Defense Battalion. They went overseas, they sent them overseas to an isolated rock after the action go, and they stagnated. Mm-hmm. They saw no action. People in ammunition companies, the people who lifted the boxes and all, ammunition companies and depot companies like mine, were in more action. Mm-hmm. We were in action, and the others, no action at all. Unless they transfer it to an ammo company or depot company. But we worked in Noumea, New Caledonia. In the morning we'd get up, and there were always ammunition to move from one place to another, or ammunition to destroy ammunition that had been left there so long that it was dangerous to use, and the way of salvaging it was or getting rid of it was to take it out and dump it in the sea. Boy, the sea, lots of stuff in it. I said, there must be a better way, but that was the way. Mm-hmm. Just dumped it, shells and hand grenades and all sorts of munitions dumped. Let's see, we did a lot of that. A lot of guard duty. And sometimes it just seemed like it was make do guard duty, because you said, what am I guarding? I mean, I said, this is my post. I don't see anything but coconut trees. No, not many coconut trees in there. That was Guadalcanal later. But in Noumea, New Caledonia, there wasn't much there to do but work and bayonet practice. We did a lot of bayonet practice. You think that one thing, if we had been attacked, we would have had a fighting chance at least. Mm-hmm. And that was due to our gunnery sergeant. Not all gunnery sergeants even taught black Marines much about bayonet practice beyond boot camp. But we had bayonet practice, we even had bayonet practice on board the LST. Mm. And that's dangerous. I mean, the ship lilting and you mm-hmm. parrying and thrusting, all those kinds of things. And I guess primarily to cut down on the boredom. I don't think anybody thought that we'd ever use a bayonet in combat. But we stayed on Noumea, New Caledonia for a long time. I don't know how long. But then we were relieved by a unit in which this gunnery sergeant, the black gunnery sergeant I told you about, that we'd never seen a black gunnery sergeant before. It was a high moment. We left there and went to Guadalcanal. More of the same. Guard duty, munitions. No, I made a mistake. It was not in Noumea, New Caledonia that we dumped ammunition in the sea. It was in Guadalcanal that we just stored lots of ammunition and moved this there and all kinds of looked like busy work. I guess it had meaning, but I never knew the meaning of it. And mine not to reason why, mine but to do or die. And so, let me see, we remained on Guadalcanal for a period. We then got on board ship and traveled long, long time till we reached Okinawa. That was where the action was. That's where we saw combat. We D-Day on Okinawa, I think, was April 1st. I remember it. April Fool's Day. I guess in a sense it was, because we thought, the Marines thought they were going to encounter Japanese the moment they hit the beach. And they couldn't find the Japanese on Okinawa when they landed. Where are they? And so it was a rather peaceful landing. They didn't have to fight their way on the beach, as usual. And my outfit didn't arrive until D-Day 30. We came in May. I've forgotten what day. But we came in May, and that fighting was in full force. I mean, it was... And there was constant noise. Ships out in the bay, boom, boom, boom. It was just constant noise from the guns and Navy shooting and shooting up in the ridges of the hills. And you just became accustomed to that sound. And the thing that, and again, we were supplying, bringing food stuff from trucks, putting them on shore, and we didn't unload ships. They had another company to do that, ammo company, ammunition company, black ammunition companies do that. So our handling of those things, not so much ammunition on Okinawa as fuel and cans of food and that sort of thing. And bang, bang, bang constantly. We felt relatively secure. We weren't too far from where the bloody stuff was taking place, but we didn't feel in imminent danger, except that kamikazes were trying to get through, and we were just hoping that the Navy would shoot them down before they got to the island. And most of the time they did. There was one instance in which a plane got through and dropped a bomb. It was a small bomb. I think it was a personnel bomb. I think he was aiming really for the camp. And a short distance from the camp was a fuel dump. We stacked up 100 octane airplane fuel. A distance from the camp. I'm glad it was as far away as it was, because that explosion sent the big cans up in the air and blowing them apart. And one person in our camp got struck by a shrapnel, a piece of steel, I guess, from the drum. He got a scratch. We kidded him. Now I guess you could go and brag about your wound in combat. And I found that he was listed in one of as one of the wounded. And I remember how we laughed at him about, but none of us got wounded. But a lot of scary moments, of course. But again, they kept us out. But some of the depot companies, Iwo Jima, guys had to fight. People who had the same kind of training that we had had and who were supposed to do the same kind of things that we were doing had to fight. So in a sense, we were just lucky, I suppose. Mm-hmm. We were in combat, but not right up on the front lines. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to... We missed D-Day. Well, Okinawa... Nobody had to fight to get on the beaches, but most of the places you had to fight just to get a foothold. And the depot companies and ammunition companies had to be close enough with the combat forces mm-hmm. that you got involved mm-hmm. because they are not, the Japanese were not respecters of person, mm-hmm. creed, or color. They love them to whomever it concerns.
I think I read that there were more people killed or wounded who were so-called non-combatants than were than
they brought the wounded.
That there were more people who were killed or wounded who were involved in loading ammo and such, the things that you were involved in.
Yes, then, those kind of companies. Mm-hmm. A number of them were wounded, some killed. Mm-hmm. They were, some actually, when there was a breakthrough for us, you know, they had to fight. And that's why, I'm sure, we were trained mm-hmm. How to use firearms and grenades and all that sort of thing, because war doesn't go according to your plan, your best wishes. They are over there, we're over here. Sometimes those people over there come over here, and then it's every Marine and the Japanese for himself and for his team. But a number of, I was surprised to read in the works that I have just recently brought myself to do. I was so bitter. I read that the founder of the, one of the founders of the Marine, of the Montford Point Marines, he said, all or nearly all Montford Point Marines have a mixture of pride and bitterness. Mm-hmm. And I said, that helped me some, because I thought maybe I was the only person like that, and because so many of the guys seem, and I've heard some of them talk, and they talked as though, well, they were accustomed to it, and they seemed to have expected it. And I didn't expect it. I must say, I did not expect mm-hmm. to be treated that way. And but in analyzing it, I think my pride was public. I had public pride. That is, when I heard the from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, any band playing something charging from me, I stay up. Are there any Marines in the house? Mm-hmm. As the other, yes. But privately, what am I standing up here for? They don't consider me a Marine. I wasn't treated as a real American. Mm-hmm. That would always haunt me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get over that until, and this perhaps is near the end of my journey. 2 years ago, I think it was, I asked Laverne to look up Montford Point Marines for me. She's computer wise, I'm not, I'm illiterate. And she found out where the that there was an association, and that they were going to have their 41st, I think, convention. 41st. And I said, well, I think I'll go to that. Well, she gave me the name of the president of the association. I called him. He's in Philadelphia. We talked. He said, I'm going to send you some material. He sent me materials, registration and all of that, and say, it's a good time for you to join up, because we're going to go back to where we started at Montfort Point Camp Lejeune. And so she and I began to process papers and get ready to take this trip to Jacksonville, North Carolina. I said, I want to see how that place is and all of that. And so we journeyed. When we got off the plane at was it Jacksonville? I've forgotten where was the plane? I've forgotten where it was, where the pilot was. I mean, where the plane took us, or was it? I don't think there's an airport in Jacksonville, but wherever we landed, there were two Marines to meet those of us who were coming home, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that struck me was that they're together. There's a white Marine, a black Marine. Montfort Point, all services, Marines are integrated now. And although this camp is now been named after one of the original and one of the legendary non-coms of the Marines, black Marines, white Marines and black Marines are now at Montfort Point. That I found salutary. But the thing that really transformed me was during our meetings, commissioned officers, black commissioned officers were there. And although I knew they existed, it was a moving experience to see them, and even more to go and speak to them and tell them what an awesome experience it was for me to see them. I said, you don't understand. There's no way I can help you understand what this means to me. Prior to that time, my service in the military had been meaningless. I couldn't find any meaning in what I had done, what I had gone through, none of it. It was an experience that wasn't lost upon me, but which I wish somehow it would get lost. And I was talking to one, a lieutenant colonel, and he was about my size and about my height. I said, and look so young, you know. Sure. You know, I'm as proud of you here as you were my own son. You know, I said, I don't know how you can possibly understand what it means to me to see a Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel in the flesh, when the highest person officer I'd seen in the Marines was a gunnery sergeant, and just got a glimpse of him to see that the transformation has taken place. I said, "It's so much." He said, and this shook me up. He said, "I want to thank you for making this possible. You, those of you who went through that." And I had never thought of that. Never in my mind had that occurred to me, that I made anything possible. I had just gone through some stuff. It didn't mean anything to anybody, or certainly not to the country. It meant something to my parents. It meant something to me. The most meaningful thing that it meant to me, the most tangible thing that the experience had meant to me, was the fact that there was a GI Bill and I found a way to go to college. Mm-hmm. That was the one thing. But all the rest...
This interview is for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress with Joseph Hester Smith, who served in the U.S. Marine Corps from June 1943 to December 1945. Today is Friday, February 8th, 2008. We are in the television studio of WILL on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana, Illinois. This is part three of this interview. My name is Harriet Williamson. Also in the studio are Henry Radcliffe, videographer and director of sound and lighting, and Mr. Smith's wife, Laverne Elizabeth Roberts Smith.
At this convention of the Montford Point Marines, I saw what really brought tears to my eyes when I sat and thought about it. And began to recall the Montford Point early years, to see all of these officers in Corps. And the transformation began, and when they, everyone I talked to, "Thank you for making it possible. We know that had it not been for what you early Montford Pointers went through, we would not be here. We would not have achieved what we have." And that was a poignant moment, because I had never thought about any contribution that I had made to anything regarding the Marine Corps. To me, it had been an isolated moment, which still caused me to be bitter and to feel wounded, and I rationalized it. I even included it in my prayers to, you know, to free me from those feelings that seemed on the surface so trivial, and yet I couldn't shake them. And that which enabled me to shake them was communicating with these young men and women. They are adults, they're young compared to an 84-year-old person. But to see them so dignified and decorated and all of that, it was a great moment, transcendent moment for me, really. And from that point on, that wound began to heal. It's not forgotten, but it no longer rubs me, and I can talk about it, and I can I can face other Marines and not feel guilty or feel inferior or any of those degrading things that I have been carrying around so many years because of little things. But the main thing was what our officers didn't do on that train. I mean, and if you can't respect, you don't get the from your superior officers. They're called superior. And I think it ought to be more than just a military kind of thing. Men of virtue and all these other kinds of things, which I assume the Marine would consider a part of being a good Marine, which they were completely lacking. I don't know any, I just can't conceive of an officer not standing up for his men just to get some coffee and donuts. And I said, if we're ever attacked, those guys will scoot away and leave us standing somewhere. If they can't stand up for a little, against a little Tupelo chapter of the American Red Cross when there's nobody around but us, what can we look upward to from them? I cannot look up to that kind of person. I just simply couldn't. And that bothered me. And with the help of my wife, Laverne, in getting me connected with Montfort Pointers, and I've since talked with some of those persons, because heretofore I have never met another black Marine since the time, yes, one who was in the Marines but who was also a friend of mine in boarding school. We met Marines. Mm-hmm. So he and I have talked about it. But he took a shortcut. He did. He got out of going overseas. He wanted to stay at home, and so he finagled his way into standing guard at, I think it was Sun Shipyard or someplace in Philadelphia. So he stayed home during the war. But he was the one only person. After I left Boston to start teaching, I taught in small towns. I finished my master's at Harvard, and then started looking for a job to teach. And I didn't want to teach in a large urban area. I wanted to teach English, and I knew from what I saw in the Boston schools that would be different unless I could get in certain schools, and I knew my chances weren't politically good for that. And so I began looking, and Harvard did too, for small towns. And so our first, after we left Boston, our first place was in Jackson, Michigan. And I never met a black Marine in Jackson, Michigan. So I continued to harbor that and those feelings. And we were there 7 years. And, no, 10 years. We were there 10 years. And then I received the call from the University of Illinois. They wanted a person with certain capacities and certain abilities to live in both worlds, as it was put, the black one and the white one, to put it straightforwardly. And what I'd been doing in Jackson, Michigan, they thought equipped me uniquely for the job that they wanted done here at the University of Illinois. So once again, we're off to pioneering. Again, I accepted the job, and I was appointed assistant professor of English and assistant to the director of admissions and records, because they wanted me to open up Chicago. The University of Illinois had been pushed and shoved by a member of the Board of Trustees, Mr. Jones. I've forgotten his first name. A lawyer from Chicago. He tried to get them to get more African-American students here. Other schools were doing it. University of Illinois, as usual, standing back, reluctant. He was pushing it. And they had been looking for somebody to sort of be the front man for that enterprise. And they had been able to find the right one. I understand it had been going on for a year or two. And the dean of admissions and records came to Jackson, Michigan, and asked his son-in-law for such a person. And he said, "I know one, but I don't think he wants to leave Jackson, Michigan, for teaching. I mean, he likes teaching, although I had become language arts coordinator for the district. I love teaching." And that was why they gave me an appointment, I think, if it was sort of to entice me for the administrative job. So I enjoy teaching for part-time. And working in admissions and records part-time, got programs started. I won't go into that. That's another story itself. And experiences getting the university committed, or getting the university active or genuinely active, that's an entirely different story. And one that's almost as dramatic as my Marine Corps experience. But anyway, we worked there, and then when the Chancellor Peltison came here, or when Peltison came here as Chancellor, he'd heard what I was doing, and this was in accord with what he wanted to do. He had come back to the university from California, University of California at Irvine, and he'd come back here to move the university forward, and he invited me to his office, to come to his office and help him out. And it was the greatest thing experienced in my life, because I never worked with a person who was genuinely concerned. Everybody else is doing it. Let's make a move. No, committed. Genuinely committed. And the thing that was so difficult with it, was that there was not genuine commitment all around every place else. When the presidents, it was like, in many ways, it was like President Roosevelt said, integrate the services. Mm-hmm. You must admit black Marines. And they said, no, 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 1,000 times no. He said, you must do it. And he said, well, okay, with all, we'll do it with all deliberate slowness. And he said, well, that's fine. You know, mm-hmm. just so you that Roosevelt Marine Corps experience is analogous to the president saying here, let's make an effort to bring in minority students, black students, because they aren't coming to the University of Illinois. And you got all this deliberate slowness by all the people who push it, the deans, department heads, and the committees, scholarship committees, and all of those kinds of things, doing something. Don't bother us with that, because we're doing this thing over here. And to get that, it had to come from somebody like Peltison, mm-hmm. because if it hadn't been for him, I would have left this place, because it was, we prevailed. So it was another experience of breaking new ground, another frontier. I told her, see, I was born, I like my, what is it, the astrological sign of Libra, or October 5th, the nice little, the balance of scales, you know, I think is a sign for October 5th, the balance. I said, I think there ought to be another one, because all of my life I've been it's new situations. I guess people born in a certain time, if they move from the microcosm of their little neighborhood, it's new ground. It just happens to be, and that's the way it has been with me. Everything seems to be pioneering, you're starting all over again, just with another subject and for another issue, another goal. It's all the same. But my Marine Corps experience, the most traumatic. I'm so pleased, delightful to be free of that Tupelo, Mississippi incident. I don't think I would have been here talking to you if I hadn't gotten over that. I'm sure I wouldn't. I said, no, I wouldn't have.
When did you meet your wife?
Pardon?
When did you meet your wife?
Oh, happy day. I was in college. I did my undergraduate work at Howard University. Oh boy, that's a story within a story. And my mother and father, as I told you, had separated and eventually divorced when I was very young. And so I knew very little about my father, except the bad things. And it wasn't from my mother so much as from my aunt and my great aunt. My great aunt the Aunt Beulah, the matriarch of our family. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't have married him in the first place. She never married and couldn't understand why anybody would ever marry her in the first place. Yes, leave him. You don't need him. And so I thought, my father must have been a bad person. And my mother said, well, no, we had some irreconcilable differences. And I laid down the law and told him he did something. Well, my father was an enterprising person. And during the Depression and all of this kind of thing, he was a manufacturer of illegal beverages. You know what it was? And my mother couldn't stand that. It was during those days of moonshine. Mm-hmm. He was a masterful person at that, something he had learned in his boyhood in Virginia. It took me a long time to get around to be able to say that, but I know from history that a lot of families were involved in those kind of things. And my mother just couldn't stand it. She said, stop that kind of business. He had a restaurant and he was doing this. I said, stay in the restaurant business. And fine. And we were doing well as far as I could tell. I remember having all kinds of little toys and things, but that was why the divorce. And so I wanted to find out something about the other side of my family, my father. Mm-hmm. I hardly knew him. And I had an aunt, his sister, Emmy Wood. And so I kept in touch with her. And I told her one summer I was in Boston, and I looked around for a job, and I couldn't find it. And I didn't want to waste the whole summer playing tennis. So I wrote and asked her if she could find a job for me if I came to Maywood, Illinois, where I was born. Mm-hmm. And she said, yes, they're hiring at the American Can Company right down the street from me. The American Can Company was an institution in Maywood. Practically every female person, many females worked at American Can. So you come and stay with me. I'd be glad to see you. And so I went to Maywood to see my aunt and get acquainted with my father. And on that particular trip, one day as I was talking to a woman whom I remembered as a boy, I call her Dirt, and she said, we call her Dirt. Her name was Gert. Her name was Gertrude, and they called her Gert, and it came out for me, she always says Dirt. She would tease me. I'm going to come and give Dirt a hug. She'd taken care of me a great deal. And so I was talking to her, and somebody else on one of the streets there. And I saw a young person coming down the street with some jeans and a sloppy kind of shirt or something on. Jeans rolled up, I think, to these. First interesting person I'd seen. Well, it was Laverne and her, and the woman, Gert was is her aunt. Hmm. And our families had known each other, as I said, for forever. And my father and her father grown up in the same woods and around the same time, I think a month or two apart, their births. And so they've been buddies all their life. So it was destined that we should come together. Mm-hmm. And we came together in a marvelous little Episcopal Chapel in Maywood, Illinois. And there has been nothing but happiness ever since. And nobody will believe that. But with all that has happened to us, with us, between us, we celebrated our 56th anniversary. I lose count. 56th mm-hmm. anniversary last December. December 27th, I think it is. So I've grown accustomed to her face. Three marvelous children. Firstborn, Pamela, who is a graduate of the University of Illinois, bachelor's and what is it, business MBA. In finance from the University of Illinois. She's now in Indianapolis. She married, unfortunately divorced, but she has our only grandchild. We have a grandson, Christopher, whom we love. I wish he hadn't grown up so quickly so I could hug him more and more, but you know, he's too big for that, but we see them rather often. Our second born is a son, Daniel. We could not persuade him to go to University of Illinois or any of the other places around here. Somehow he thought that since I was an East Coast person, he should go to the East Coast. And since I had left some footprints at Harvard, he should go to Harvard. I didn't think that he was quite the... He was a good scholar, but I didn't think he had the toughness, the scholarly toughness. I thought my daughter did. I tried to persuade her to go, and she could have gone, but at that time, Harvard admitted women through Radcliffe. Mm-hmm. They had to come by way of Radcliffe. And she said, I will not go into any side door. And she wasn't interested in going to Harvard. But I thought somehow she had the, it wasn't just bright, it was kind of toughness that was required. But Daniel went and he survived it. I told him I wouldn't ask about his grades as long as he did it in 4 years, because that's as far as I go. So he was graduated with an illustrious class and all that. And he's making a living at, I don't know what my children do. They're all in computer things, and they don't do any of the old-fashioned things anymore. And then there's the little one, the littlest angel, Jocelyn, who is the she's married. Daniel isn't married, but she married her, but married rather late, and so she couldn't bear his children. She went to the University of Wisconsin and decided she wanted to study journalism. I said, you know, why journalism? Oh, I like to write. Oh, you can write. You don't have to go to journalism class, right? And you aren't going to be a journalist, and you can't push your way into setting and get news. Or she's very, the most quiet and generally, she has some steel there, though, but I didn't think that she was equipped for that. She said, well, I plan to do magazines. I don't know. I said, you know what? You've got to do, you're lucky and a lot of writing before you can get a magazine. But she went in and it served her well, but she's doing some computer things, and she writes right now. She's the editor of her church paper. She's in Virginia, Annandale, Virginia. At is it Grace Episcopal?
St. Barnabas.
The Episcopal Church, and she is the editor of the newsletter, and they turn out a real newsletter, and not one of the little dinky one-page folded over things. And she's in charge of that. She says, see, journalism. And she's the one who helps me with my memoirs. And,
well, I hope that you and pushes have that me. Published.
Yeah, she pushes me into it. She's typed up some things for me, and she keeps me at it. And so all of my children live, and I love them for their uniqueness. They're different, but they all contribute to my well-being in different ways.
Well, it has been a great honor to have you here and to hear your narrative. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope that this makes sense to somebody. I don't know when you're talking how things will come out, but c'est la vie.
Henry, did you want to ask anything further? Thank you.